You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
I would like to welcome to the stage the keynote speaker for today's luncheon, Admiral Gary Ruffhead, who will be introduced and interviewed by the Honorable Catherine Wheelbarger. Ms. Wheelbarger served as counsel to Vice President Dick Cheney, as Deputy Staff Director and Senior Counsel on the House Select Committee on Intelligence, and as Policy Director and Counsel to the Senate Armed Services Committee. So she has this somewhat checkered background in dealing with issues of intelligence and security. She subsequently served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for international security affairs in an acting capacity, and I'm pleased to say she is also a member of our board. Admiral.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you, everybody, for being here today for this important event that I think is part and parcel of what USIP does for this country. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce our distinguished guest, Admiral Gary Ruffhead, whose extraordinary career and expertise make him uniquely qualified to address today our most pressing challenges in strategic stability and national security. He is a former U.S. Navy Chief of Naval Operations and has commanded both U.S. Pacific and Atlantic fleets. He is now the Robert and Marion Oster Distinguished Fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. Beyond his military service, Admiral Ruffhead brings extensive experience from the private sector, and academia, and currently serves on industry and academic boards. He also contributes his expertise to the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory and serves on the International Advisory Committee of the Maritime Policy Center in Haifa, Israel. He is also a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. He's also a longtime friend of the U.S. Institute of Peace. It's my distinct pleasure to have you here today. Thank you so much for joining us. So,
thank you, Katie.
So we'll just dive right in.
Before we do, I would just like to thank USIP for the invitation to participate. And I applaud the Institute for this event and bringing those who have served and those who will serve together to pass the baton at a particularly interesting time in our world. But beyond that, I would also applaud USIP for what they do and what they have done over the years. One thing that's not in my biography is I did not grow up in the United States. I grew up in countries to which I can't return. And it's that way because of the conflicts, because of governments that have taken those countries in a different and bad direction. And what USIP does is, one, to try to resolve those conflicts, and the other is to keep that from happening. So Ambassador, and all of the people at USIP, thank you for what you do. It's incredibly important. It will become more important in the future as we move into a very, very different world.
Thank you. And as we look at that geopolitical landscape and an era of increasing complexity and the topic du jour of being strategic stability, let's reflecting on that concept, particularly given your background as CNO and with the shifting tides of the environment. How do you think about that concept today?
Yeah. If you go back to some of the initial concepts of strategic stability, it takes you into the nuclear realm. And even though I think we may be getting closer to a line of instability, the fact that we have some significant conflicts going on in the world with countries that possess nuclear weapons, the fact that they have stayed in the locker, I think speaks volumes. But times are changing. And I think that on the nuclear side, particularly as we move forward, and we should move forward quickly on the recapitalization of our deterrent, I think that the stability will be there. But I'm also concerned with the fact that we no longer have the venues and the methods to be able to bring people together to talk about things like arms control, particularly nuclear arms control. They seem to be waning quickly. On the conventional side, I would put us in a very unstable position. The fact that there are two brutal wars that are taking place, the tensions in the Western Pacific, what I call the malign alignment that we see playing out and has been playing out for some time. For about the last decade, it's been of interest to me to see the old empires of Eurasia beginning to stir, and now they have aligned. And whether it's the Chinese Empire, the Russian Empire, the Persian Empire, and I would say as a result of events in Syria, I would not be surprised if we see the Ottomans begin to look at the Middle East in a very, very different way. So, you know, I think it's important that we look back on history, look back on the drivers of those countries and cultures, and that's going to play out. We also are moving into a technological period, the likes of which, you know, we've not seen before. I mean, you can go back in history and people talk about how technology has always been changing. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is from one of my predecessors as CNO, who in 1923 said, "Going to sea used to be fun, and then they gave us radios." So technology is not new. But I think the other thing that we have in play, and this is also an area where USIP, I think, is really going to earn their stripes, there's no question in my mind that the planet is changing. And we can argue, you know, all the whys and wherefores. But in the future, we are going to be seeing wars being fought over water, food. And so, you know, it is a very different time. But I think it's also important that we look at ourselves as well. And I'll kind of go off onto the military track a little bit here. And that, you know, we are spread quite thin as a military around the world. When you look at what's happening in Europe, Middle East, and particularly in the Western Pacific, our defense industrial base is running pretty lean, I believe. One area that you would expect is of great interest to me is the maritime space, where China has really, in an extraordinary way, come on as a maritime power. Not necessarily a global naval power, but truly a maritime power when you look at its shipbuilding, shipping, ports, ship financing. It really has changed in that regard over the last two decades. My concern is I think we're facing a real crisis in our maritime workforce. And many people, when you've seen it in the press, about shipyard workforces that are being challenged. But the thing that we don't pay enough of attention to, and I give great credit to soon-to-be Secretary Rubio, National Security Advisor Waltz, and Senator Kelly for really putting a spotlight on American civilian mariners. And I hope that when they are in office, that they work with Congress to fix that. Because one of the great challenges that we're going to face, particularly in the Western Pacific, is logistics. You know, we get enamored by the most recent technology or the most recent weapon. But the American way of war and where we prevailed is through logistics. Mm-hmm. And if we don't pay attention to that, it's going to be a huge shortcoming. Sorry for rambling, Kate.
No, it's perfect. And you touched on the challenges of the military tool, both in terms of the complexity of the global environment and needing to do a lot of things in a lot of places, but also, you know, we are always in a resource-constrained environment. So that leads us to the question of what in your opinion, is the military to focus on? And what other tools of national power should be doing where? When I was in the department, I was always very focused on security cooperation issues, and if the entire, you know, conventional force needs to be focused on the Pacific, then maybe we should think about these less costly cooperation tools. The priority should not just, everything shouldn't move to the Pacific. Maybe we double down on security cooperation in, you know, South America or something like that. So how do you think of which tools of national power, particularly at USIP, as we heard from the ambassadors earlier, here to mitigate, avoid, and stop wars? What tools should be used where?
Well, I think, it's the catchphrase of every administration, you know, we have to rebuild our military. But I really do think that we have to really focus on the defense industrial base. And it is important that we don't lose sight of the fact that, all of the old stuff is still going to be useful. You know, there was a time, I think, while we were involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, that was a particular kind of war. And the next big one, that the effects would be heard as clicks on a keyboard and not the concussion of cannons. And just ask the people in Ukraine if that's the way the war is playing out. And as I look at the Pacific, truly there's going to be new technology, but we really need to look at getting the industrial base reset. There has to be predictability in defense appropriations. You know, for the last, probably since these events began, every study, every review has talked about the insidious effects of continuing resolutions. Nothing has changed. So, that's one thing. But the other is also, how do we bring in the new technology? And this is where I think we have a bit of a deficiency. We tend to become enamored with the technology. And what I've observed with China, whether it's in the commercial sector and their Belt and Road Initiative or in the defense space, they focus on the application. The technology may not be as good as ours, but they get the app out there. And once it's out there, then the learning curve begins. And so we need to be able to introduce that faster. We need to be able to engage in exploratory technologies and fund those in a way that allow companies to make mistakes and to reset. But we also have to give it a timeline. Now, in the other aspects, diplomacy and development are, in my mind, game changers. We can send our troops to engage in various countries around the world, but development is required. A few years ago, I co-chaired a study at the Council on Foreign Relations on the Belt and Road. And I've been watching the Belt and Road since about 2010 on a visit to Cambodia in my past professional life. That was my first physical view of what the Belt and Road was. But after we did the study, we were engaging with some diplomats in Southeast Asia. And at the end of it, they said, you guys got it right. You know, it is predatory. It doesn't create a workforce that advances our country, but we need development and we're going to get it where we can get it. Another case was visiting a country where China was building a new port. And we raised that issue. Some colleagues and I raised the issue, eventually moved up to high levels of government. And they said, we got it. We need some more controls as to what's going on. And as we're leaving the conversation, one of the officials said, you need to understand one thing. We needed the port, and the only people that bid on it was China. And so we need to think about how we bring that into play. We need to think about how we can employ organizations like USIP very effectively. And I think the other area where China has been successful on the diplomacy side is it tends to happen at the at the national level for us. But China is at the national level, they're at the regional level, and they're at the municipal level. And they're bringing that technology, the old Belt and Road of the brick and mortar. It's now going to be digital, it's going to be health, it's going to be energy, and they're going to be working all levels. And if we don't, working with business, working with other institutions other than the government, we're going to be at a disadvantage. So diplomacy and development are absolutely key.
One of the key technologies is looking at the new technology-infused military, for example, and needing to more rapidly adopt technologies that we hear a lot about is artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. and how that's going to change a lot of how we do business and how we do military operations. What are your thoughts on both how we should be better equipped to adopt those technologies, like what do we need to do better to allow that to happen in the department, but also how do we deploy those technologies better?
You know, if you go into the Department of Defense, I would say you go into any department in the government today, and you're going to find a new innovation office. And we have a lot of these entities that are springing up to do innovation. And that's more overhead. But what is the output of all of those? And so what we really need to be able to do is, how do we take the benefits of AI, whether it's in a commercial space or in the military, and get it out there? And this is where it sounds like I'm using the China model. We have to move to the apps faster. We can't simply worship the technology. We have to get it out there. Within defense, there are some systems that, you know, someone might say, well, you know, you're a dinosaur and you just want to build more new airplanes or whatever. But it's in those platforms where we're going to use AI to enable them. If we don't build them, we're not going to be getting it out there to begin that learning curve. The other area that I think about quite a bit is AI as it applies to the nuclear enterprise and the use of AI in nuclear command and control. In conversations I've had with Chinese interlocutors, you can infer, and they probably infer from us, that that's not a good idea. But I just asked the question, when has a military not employed breakthrough technology? When it's been there and they said, that's breakthrough technology, we're just going to put it aside. That has never happened. Now, I think that there is a desire to not let AI take over the nuclear deterrent. But what will all the peripherals be that are running on AI? Do we understand that? Do we understand what an adversary might be using that AI for? And so I think we really need to spend a lot of time thinking about that. And that's why I believe some of the dialogues, as frustrating as they can be, we have to be able to continue to talk. Because if we don't get the insights and we miss the opportunities to perhaps steer and influence.
With the rise of those advanced technologies, not just AI, but cyber at large, space, comes with an increasingly complex discussion of deterrence as a doctrine. So what are your thoughts of how we increase the deterrent capabilities of the United States in a world of these increasingly, rapidly adapting technologies?
I think, we've been moving on cyber, but the area of concern for me are some of the public infrastructure, mm-hmm. and how do we go back and get back into systems that have been there for decades, and how do we harden those up on the cyber front? I think AI and cyber defense is going to be big. Mm-hmm. But there is no question that space is you've heard the folks talk about it as a warfighting domain. It is going to become more important rather than less important. And, and when the idea of a space force was kicking around, I was an early proponent of that. A lot of people were surprised that this Navy guy is just supporting the Air Force, but that's true. Because I will tell you, in today's world, sea power depends on space power. because we don't have the cables that you can stretch across the ocean and plug into your ships. It's all about space. And so the work that we're doing there to harden, provide countermeasures, provide counters, this is hard stuff. But I think we have to move there. I think we also need to begin to think in terms of moving into that, what they call cislunar space, which is between Earth and the moon. That is going to open up entire new opportunities to even go beyond the moon. And this is where I think it's so important that we fall back on our strengths. And as Katie mentioned, I'm affiliated with the university. I'm affiliated with a university affiliated research center. And the work that comes out of those institutions doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. The one with which I'm affiliated, if you just think back on Christmas Eve, the Parker Solar Probe doing science closer to the sun than any object has ever flown before. The same organization did planetary defense and did the DART experiment that deflected a meteor. Also flew a spacecraft farther from the Earth than ever before. That requires engineering, it requires science, it requires a unique intellectual capability that in the United States we have the crown jewels. And there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how universities might be changing over time. We better do no harm, because that's the secret sauce for us. You couple that with the ability to get this technology applied more quickly, mm-hmm. and no one's going to be able to beat us. So it's intellectual capability, it's creating the environment and the mechanisms to allow some of this exploratory science to take place, and as efficient as we want to be, fixed price contracts are probably not the way to move into the future. You're going to fail. Things won't go well. You need to build some prototypes and then get that the build going so that you can get a learning curve. And that's going to be a big change. And to beat the drum again, maybe this time it'll be different. You don't do that with CRs, continuing resolutions.
John's going to fix that.
I'm sorry?
I said John's going to fix that, our congressional expert. So last question from me, and then I'll open up to the audience. I think we have a few minutes designated for questions from you. Sort of shifting a little bit from the technology to just pure policy questions. So we have an incoming team. What would be your advice to them on policy priorities, policy implementation, but also how you think about, they should think about partners and allies going forward in this complex world?
Yeah. Well, I'm an unabashed proponent of alliances. I can tell you that whether I was a fleet commander or the head of the Navy, I could not have done the things that we did around the world without our allies. It's as simple as that. I think it's particularly critical in the Asia Pacific. The distances are long. We don't have that established NATO infrastructure that we have in Europe. For the record, I'm not advocating for an Asian NATO. But the fact of the matter is we have to really think about our allies in Asia, particularly Japan, Australia, Southeast Asia. It's so, so very important. And one of the things that I think is missed, we in the Navy forward, we call it forward deploying ships that are permanently assigned in places, for example, in Japan. And I call that the mega ball, because if you want to have 10 ships forward in the Western Pacific, it takes 5 ships to make one because of maintenance, going, coming, training. So if I didn't have that ability to have assets forward, instead of the 10 ships that are there, I'd have to have 50 mm-hmm. in order to have the 10. It's simple math. And our association and relationships that we have with allies allow us to do it. There's also a lot of great technology that comes out of it. And the allies can help us do things that we can't. And so for an incoming team, alliances are important. I think we're also in a time, as we recommended, you know, Paul and I were on the same defense commission two administrations ago. We are really into a two-front environment because of these stirring empires. And as hard as it will be, I do think we need to have a force that's capable of two wars. We no longer have that luxury because of the way this maligned alignment has taken place. It's not going to be one here, one there. It will be coordinated. And particularly in the Western Pacific, if anything were to happen in Taiwan, you can bet that North Korea and Russia are going to cause problems to the north of Japan, and that becomes a two-front problem for Japan. So we really need to think about that. We need to move the innovation more quickly. We need to provide predictability. And we also need to make sure that we're investing in the human capital and creating the opportunities to build for the future and to encourage young people that that's something they can do, that's something they want to do, and that they'll be fulfilled in doing that. And that's not just for the uniform types. One of the things that I've always thought is we should afford young men and women in the State Department and our civilians within the Department of Defense the same type of developmental opportunities that we give our uniformed officers, postgraduate schools and service colleges. We really need to show them that we care and that we're willing to invest in their futures.
Thank you. All right, we have a few minutes for audience questions. Yes, Nancy.
Thank you very much, Admiral. That's a very interesting perspective you have, and talking about a lot of the deficiencies that we have and the future. If you could give any advice to the incoming administration over the steps in the first 6 months or even a year, what would that be?
I think what I would give them the advice would be value the alliances and understand why they're important. The other would be to really move quickly on some of the innovative technologies. The system, the procurement system, acquisition system, whatever you want to call it, within the Department of Defense, and I would argue probably the rest of government, has become much more process-focused than outcome-focused. And I would venture to say that you probably have had more people get in hot water in acquisition because they deviated from the process, not because they didn't deliver a product that was effective. And so really go after that. I think it's also important on some of these really critical technologies that we're trying to move on is that we really need to keep leadership in position a long enough time to where they can be held accountable. When I look back at some of the transformational things that have happened in warfare, starting with the atomic bomb, and following that with the nuclear submarine, which really made a submarine truly a submarine, and the third in the world that I lived in my time of the Navy, integrated air and missile defense, which I think is going to become hugely important. What was common among those three programs? There was one person in charge for a long time, and they controlled everything. It was Groves and the Manhattan Project. It was Hyman Rickover for the nuclear submarine. And it was a gentleman by the name of Wayne Meyer for integrated air and missile defense. One could argue Hyman Rickover maybe stayed a little bit longer than he should have. But the fact of the matter is that we really need to not have people skipping around, but dig in, ride that. It has to span administrations. It can't simply change and change and change. And I would submit on AI, some of the space initiatives, that's the type of program that we have to have. I'm loath to call it another Manhattan Project, but but I think you understand what I'm saying.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you, Admiral, for your remarks. They're thoughtful. My name is Kemba Walden. I am the president of Paladin Global Institute, which is linked to a venture capital firm looking at policy and mission as it aligns its capital with U.S. and allied mission. So my question is what you've described to me and what I've experienced, that this is an all-hands situation. How do you think, what do you think the role of private capital could be in terms of investing, innovation, maybe countering what we've seen China and Russia and others do in countries that are close to us in providing services and innovation?
Yeah.
What's the role for private capital?
I think that there are some applications of technology that private capital may be able to be used to bridge what they call the Valley of Death. And if you can adjust the approach and the attitude within the acquisition system, private capital may be that bridging function. Because, you know, I've met with some companies recently where there have been investments, but because there isn't a predictive runway, it's going to die. And so is that a function? And you understand the business far better than I, but I think partnering with government in a way that can bridge some of this new technology into the future, I think would be important.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Admiral. Thank you, Kathleen. I'm Ray Dubois, a member of the USIP International Advisory Council.
And I can tell this is going to be a hard question, Ray, because you always ask me hard questions.
And I come from the land of the formers. Given your commands both in the Pacific Fleet Command and Fleet Forces Command in the Atlantic, you are particularly, I think, qualified to address the renewed discussion on the Panama Canal and how it's managed to the benefit of our country and our industry and our economy and our security. Various individuals have placed flags on various pieces of property, like the Chinese at both ends. So I'd like your views.
Yeah. I think that even though the Chinese ports are on either end, I can go to other strategic areas around the world and the Chinese ports are there. That's our bad, because I think as they were building out, we should have been looking at it from a strategic standpoint. And when you look at the map, it's really a pretty thoughtful lay down of where these ports are. That said, I do not see that those ports are going to constrain us as we try to move things back and forth. If there were to be a conflict, I think that would be a manageable problem. I touched on it earlier. One of the biggest issues that the Panama Canal faced in the past year had nothing to do with who was controlling the ports. It had everything to do with how much water there was. And so, it's easy to get wrapped up on the potential controls on either end, but there are other issues as well. But right now, that is not high on my list. What has really disrupted global commerce, or has changed global commerce, and made it a bit more expensive, is the Houthi proxies in Yemen. They have completely changed the flows into the Red Sea, deprived Egypt of a significant amount of revenue, and I think it's safe to assume that the amount of money that Iran gives the Houthis is about the same as it costs to run a big think tank in Washington, D.C. And so that's a little more, bit more disruptive than who has the port on the either end. And we need to think a little bit more about that.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. Yes, please.
Thank you, Cindy Corville. Thank you for your presentation. Two questions. One in terms of the African continent and Africa Command. What do we do to enhance its capability and our engagement with the African states? The second one is on the intelligence, because I also have an intelligence background. What are we going to do with both open source as well as classified to produce and collect data and to produce pieces that are informative not only for the military, but more informative for the policymakers? Thank you.
Right. One of the things I think, particularly for Africa, is the fact that I think business and organizations like USIP need to play a huge role. And that, in my view, should be the thrust. Right now we're captured by Europe, Western Pacific, Middle East, but the challenges that Africa will face are going to be significant. The conflicts that are already taking place there are significant, but it's also going to be a place where there's going to be a rush for the resources of Africa and exploitation of the populations in Africa. And that's where I think the U.S. could play, but that's not a military function. The other thing I think, as I've thought about it, and there are more Africa experts in here than I am, but we really need to, in my view, think about Africa and its many different parts. As a kid, I lived in North Africa. That's very different than sub-Saharan Africa. The East Africa is very different than West Africa. And we have to have a more sophisticated approach. We have to have a strategy that takes into account what those differences are. We have to realize that there are going to be some significant demographic health resource issues in Africa. And how do we come at it in a way that's effective? It's very easy to say all of that. But I think for too long, we've thought about Africa as this, singular entity. And it's so very, very different. I would argue that we're behind the power curve because China's in there in a big way, Russia in a very malign way, and we've got to get our game going. And that's why I think it's so important as we talk about building out the military, but also developing the next generation of national security professionals, State Department, intelligence community. But we really need, I believe, the private sector to be part of the solution and change our position in Africa in ways that are tailored to the various regions that exist. But I defer to the ambassador to refine on that. Now, on intelligence, I probably should defer to Katie, who's here. What's really changed so much over time is how much information is available in the public space. And I would say that our institutions, although they're trying to move in that direction, there's just so much information that can be gleaned that way. And there are companies that are actually obviously making a lot of money doing it. But I think the information domain that we are living in and that we'll continue to live in, and the reliance people will have on social media is also one of the great changes that future generations and the upcoming administration is going to have to deal with. It's a different time. It's a different time technologically, socially, physically, and the old playbook isn't going to work. So we need to be thinking differently, and we need the best and brightest young minds who want to come into the government to help us do that. Because that's the future. And I'm hopeful that when the baton is passed, that becomes part of a strategy going forward. all the military kit that you have. Our secret sauce are the wonderful people that we have in the military, in our diplomatic corps, and in organizations like USIP that go out and do the hard work. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Join me in thanking the Admiral for his time today. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.